Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
We're back, and to prove it, we're here. 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Coming to your phone calls in a moment. First, though, I need to share with you a troubling story. I wish I didn't have to, but this is... You know how sometimes I talk about how strange things are in the Catholic Church lately, and a lot of confusing and troubling things that seem to go on, and ambiguities and just stuff like that? You know what I'm talking about, right? Well, as if those things weren't enough, this story being reported by Catholic World Report, it's being reported, of course, in the secular press, but it's certainly being covered widely in the Catholic press in the last few days, and I want to bring it to your attention because I have a problem with it. The Pontifical Academy for Life issued a statement yesterday defending the recent appointment of an outspoken advocate for abortion rights on the grounds that members are chosen to contribute to fruitful interdisciplinary, intercultural, and interreligious dialogue. And you say, okay, so why are they appointing an abortion, quote-unquote, rights advocate? Nobody has the right to kill an unborn person. Nobody has the right to kill an innocent human life. So when you see the phrase abortion rights, please understand that that is, it's simply not true on the face of it, but that's the way in which people talk about it. An Italian-American economist and professor at University College London, Mariana Mazzucato, was among seven academics appointed by Pope Francis on October the 15th to serve five-year terms with the Academy. The Catholic News Association reported on October 18th, on several occasions, Mazzucato shared her pro-abortion views on Twitter when Roe v. Wade was overturned by the United States Supreme Court. The statement from the Communications Office of the Pontifical Academy for Life, which was sent to journalists covering the Vatican, said, Fabrizio Mastrofini, the Pontifical Academy for Life, asks me to share this message in which he explains the controversy regarding the recent appointment. The statement then refers to comments made by Archbishop Vincenzo Paglia, the president and chancellor of the Pontifical Academy for Life, announcing the appointments. The press release says, consider this phrase above all. It is important that women and men with skills in various disciplines and from different contexts enter the Pontifical Academy for Life for a constant and fruitful interdisciplinary, intercultural, and interreligious dialogue. This is why, it says, among the academics, there are also non-Catholic people, two rabbis, a Shinto academician, Muslims, an Anglican theologian also. The Pontifical Academy for Life is a study and research body, so the debate and dialogue takes place between people of different backgrounds. The press release notes that any documents published by the Pontifical Academy for Life go through a vetting process. The press release reads, when the Pontifical Academy for Life publishes documents, as in the case of the five notes on COVID-19, then the documents are sent to the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith before being published. The statement also explains that Pope Francis nominated the members of the Academy, who then made it through the selection process without any red flags being raised. The statement also says, all academics are chosen from among scientists and experts of absolute importance, as Pope Francis reiterated in the letter Humana Communitas, the 2019 document to the Pontifical Academy for Life, the nominations of the ordinary academics are made by the Pope. So I'm going to pause here. This is not a situation in which some shadowy backroom group of unnamed people decided to invite this outrageously inappropriate person, Mariana Mazzucato, outrageously inappropriate to be one of the people serving a term on the Pontifical Academy for Life, which the whole point of it is to uphold and defend and promote the protection of human life in all of its stages, and certainly, most importantly, perhaps, unborn human life, which is under attack in such a particular way. It wasn't some unnamed bureaucrat or some you know, anonymous committee who nominated this woman to be on. This was Pope Francis himself. The Pontifical Academy for Life was formed by Pope St. John Paul II in 1994 with a pro-life mission to, quote, study information and formation on the principal problems of biomedicine and of law relative to the promotion and defense of life, above all in the direct relation that they have with Christian morality and the directives of the Church's magisterium. The Academy's first president, Venerable Jerome Lejeune, establishing bylaws requiring the members of the Academy to sign a declaration stating, quote, before God and men, we bear witness that for us every human being is a person, and that from the moment the embryo is formed until death, it is the same human being which grows to maturity and dies. In 2016, however, with the appointment of Archbishop Paglia as the president of the Pontifical Academy for Life, Pope Francis approved new statutes that eliminated the requirement that members declare themselves to be pro-life. However, the Academy's new statutes still require members to conform with church teaching. I don't think that Mariana Mazzucato is going to conform with church teaching on this issue because she's out there very publicly saying how much she disagrees with the church's teaching. And yet, curiously, she was nominated to be in this organization. The statutes also say that members or academicians appointed by the Pope can be of any religion, though they should, quote, promote and defend the principles regarding the value of life and dignity of the human person, interpreted in a way that conforms to the magisterium of the Church. I don't see how that's possible in this case. And also, an academician can have his or her membership revoked, the statutes say, in the case of a public and deliberate action or statement manifestly contrary to said principles or seriously offensive to the dignity and credibility of the Catholic Church and the Academy of Life itself. All you have to do is look at her statements on social media because they fulfill to a T exactly that provision. So the reason I'm bringing this to your attention is because this is, as I say, being widely reported in the Catholic world. It's a new phenomenon. It just took place in the last few days. If you ask me, I think this is scandalous. And if nothing else, how is the average Catholic supposed to understand this? What signals does this send? What is this supposed to mean? I mean, I was trying to think of a good analogy. I'm not sure if I have a perfect analogy, but this analogy comes to mind. Let's imagine that instead of the Pontifical Academy for Life, what if it was the Pontifical Academy for Anti-Racism? Okay. All right. So let's say there were a Pontifical Academy for the promotion of harmony between the races and between ethnic groups. And the whole point of this Pontifical Academy was to foster a means of helping people turn away from racism. What would it mean then if, let's say, the Grand Dragon of the Ku Klux Klan were named to that academy? You know, his express purpose in life as a member of the KKK is to foment and to gin up racial disharmony and to promote racism and all of the above. That's probably the only analogy that comes to my mind that would be equally as shocking. Like, why would that person have a place on this Pontifical Academy? And I don't think I need to explain it any further than that. I mean, I think you can see what the problem is. So everybody everywhere is just scratching their heads and saying, what is going on here? And I don't know the answer to that. I don't know the answer to that. But people from time to time will call up or they'll write and they'll say, well, what did Pope Francis mean by this? And what did he mean when he said that? And I can only go back to what I have said countless times before. And that is, number one, he's the Pope and it's his responsibility to, when it's necessary, to explain if he chooses to do so. He doesn't always choose to do so. But if something like this, and this to my mind is one of these things that is just a head scratcher where you say, I don't understand why you would do this or why anybody would do this. This gets back to the issue of, as Pope Francis himself says to us all the time, please pray for me, please pray for me. So really, 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 let's take him up on that and pray for him. Pray for him that the Lord will give him the graces necessary to be the very best Pope he can be. And to do the right things. And anything we would expect from any other pope, we would ask the same thing for him. So as you see stories like this, And in the absence of any explanation from Pope Francis, I mean, it's up to him to explain his own actions. I can't explain them. You can't explain them. It's not my job to interpret them or anything else, but pray for Pope Francis that these kinds of things will at least have with them some kind of an explanation, whatever that might be. But to go back to what I was saying a minute ago, it's not my place to sit in criticism of anybody. All I'm doing is just saying, here's a story widely reported. Everybody's looking at this, and it's really difficult, if not impossible, to understand what's going on here. So pray, pray, pray. That would be my best advice. That's what I do myself. Pray, pray, pray. 888-914-9145. Let's go to Myra now. Excuse me. Is it Myra or Maria? I think it's Maria in Tampa, right? Right, Maria?
It's Maria.
Maria. My mistake. Welcome.
Maria. Thank you. So I'm calling because I help lead a mom's group here in Tampa at my parish. Okay. And we're having a discussion next week on child loss and miscarriage.
Okay.
And mostly on, like, how do you, accompany a friend or whatnot if they're going through that. It can be difficult. And another question that comes up, and I just want to, I don't want to misspeak on any topics. So what do we believe as Catholics about children who die in miscarriage or in the womb? I know my kids have asked that. It's come up in their classrooms. And I just want to know the correct answer so I don't mislead
anybody. No, that's good. And it's such a common thing that I hardly know anybody who hasn't been affected by that in some way or another. So my advice would be go to the Vatican website. It's vatican.va. And for some strange reason, you have to put the W's in there. So www.vatican.va. And what you want to get is the International Theological Commission, The Hope of Salvation for Infants Who Die Without Being Baptized. And that, of course, pertains to the children that you're referring to. And it is a detailed biblical and theological analysis of what the church's position is on what happens to them. You know, do they go to heaven? Mm-hmm. They don't go to hell. What happens to them? So I can give you a summary of this document, but I would encourage you to read it and then share it with the other ladies that are in this group. And we'll get a link to this posted for you also, Maria. Yeah. And for those who wonder, you'll be able to get that link in just a minute by going to either the show Twitter feed at P Madrid Show, or if you go to the show page, and that's relevantradio.com/Patrick, you'll find it in the lower right-hand corner where the Twitter feed is embedded. So to summarize the point, Maria, the opinion that has held, you might say, the majority view among theologians for many, many centuries in the Catholic Church was one known as limbo. And limbo is a way of trying to determine what would happen to souls of those who were not baptized, in the case of infants, who had never been able to sin, so they didn't have anything that they did against God. But because we all inherit the condition of original sin, which means the absence of sanctifying grace, we need a Savior, we need to receive the grace of the Lord in order to be able to be happy with Him in heaven. If they don't receive the sacrament of baptism, how did they receive sanctifying grace? And so the opinion of limbo has been that they go to a place of perfect natural happiness, where they are in a state that is far better, far more happy and blissful than anything, even on your best day, that you would ever experience in this life. But it's natural happiness. It's not supernatural happiness. In other words, they don't see God face to face. And the theory holds that those who are in limbo, if there is a limbo, that they're not even aware that there's some place better than where they are. And so this is understood that God in His mercy and generosity provides them with the best possible place for natural happiness. And it would be something, let's say, even better than the Garden of Eden. That's the idea. And the reason that limbo was such a popular and such a widely held opinion is because it satisfies, at least it's one way of trying to satisfy, the question of, if you can't go to heaven without sanctifying grace, and they don't have sanctifying grace, and in God's mercy, He would not condemn somebody who did not commit a sin, and they didn't commit a sin, there must be some place where they can go that it's not heaven, but it's also not punishment. So that's the theory behind limbo. So what this document does is it takes notice of that, and it discusses that briefly, but it points us in a different direction, and that is to trust in the mercy and forgiveness of God, and in particular, his love for these unborn children who die in the womb. And again, to summarize, what this document says is that we should, rather than hold to limbo, you're free to hold that view if you wish, but the church says rather it would be better to pray for these unborn children and to hope that there will be a way that's not been revealed to us that God will provide them with sanctifying grace outside of the sacrament of baptism, and that they will indeed be in heaven. So on the one hand, the church doesn't say that they are certainly in heaven, but the church says that there's every reason to hope that they will be in heaven. So when you talk to people who have had miscarriages and they say, well, we have three children and two in heaven, I know what they mean. And I'm sure maybe for many of them, they just assume that those children are in heaven. And the church doesn't say that. The church doesn't say you can assume that they are in heaven, but rather hope that in God's mercy that they may be in heaven. But the last thing I'll say, Marja, is that wherever they are, it will be the absolute best thing. God will not do anything by half measures. He doesn't do the second best or the third best. Whatever the perfect thing is, taking into account justice and mercy, that's what these little babies are going to get. And we have every reason to hope that we'll see them in heaven.
Got it. Great. Yeah, I mean, so it would be inaccurate to say to your kids, like, oh, they're in heaven. Or, like, would you just totally avoid saying that? Or would you say it because...
I would say something like, you know,
what do you say?
Yeah, what I would say is that, you know, we know that God loves this little baby, and as much as we love this baby, God loves the baby more than we do, and we're trusting in God's mercy that that baby will be in heaven. And when we get to heaven, we hope to see that baby in heaven. That's how I would share it with my children.
Got it. And then, so yeah. One more thing, then would you, some people will say, like, I mean, I'm guessing it's the same answer. We don't quite know, but they'll say, like, oh, pray for the intercession of your, you know, the sibling that you lost in miscarriage. Would you avoid that?
Well, I mean, if they're in heaven, they could intercede for you. They would certainly do that. No, I wouldn't do that. I personally would say what the church says, and that is, I hope that this baby is in heaven. Our number 12 died in miscarriage. Our first 11 children were all born happy and healthy. So number 12, much to our surprise, died in miscarriage. So I have a child somewhere, like so many other people do, and I hope and pray that that baby is in heaven. And in the meantime, I'm just trusting in God. I try to just leave it at that. Thanks, Marja. I appreciate it. I'll be right back. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
That would be me. Welcome back to the show. Thank you for listening. I want to remind you of a novena that we're going to be beginning November the 2nd through the 10th. This is the novena for the Holy Souls. And we're celebrating the lives of your friends and your family who have passed away and were praying for their entry into the kingdom of heaven. And you can join us in praying for these people. In fact, you can tell us whom you would like us to pray for. All you have to do is go to relevantradio.com/souls. That's relevantradio.com/souls. And you could submit up to 20 names of your departed loved ones. We're not doing a genealogy. We're not data mining or anything like that. We just would like to know by name who these loved ones are. And I promise you, we will be praying for them. So families all around the country, all around the world, listening on our global app, can participate wherever you may be. All you have to do to make sure that your loved ones are prayed for in this novena is go to relevantradio.com/souls. You have between now and November the 10th. And when you submit the names of the souls you'd like us to pray for, you'll also receive reflections from Father Rocky each day during the novena to help you enter more deeply into prayer. So once again, go to relevantradio.com/souls, and you can do that between now and November 10th. Thank you.
Hey, Patrick, I have an email here. This is from Erica in Austin, Texas, listening on 970 AM KIXL. All right. She says, wow, shook, in the subject line, and her message is, wow, Patrick, your message to the Catholics not feeling fed in the church was amazing. I got goosebumps. Mm. I stand with you, and this is exactly what I tell my non-denominational friends as the reason why I will never be interested in leaving this treasure. Once God reveals this to you, there is no need to seek anything anywhere else. Your message was powerful. Thank you, Erica.
Well, thank you, Erica. Yeah, maybe so because I feel so strongly about it. Cyrus, perhaps we can package that up as a social media clip.
Yeah, that's good.
If it had that effect. You know, I heard someone say, Cyrus, that those who say, I'm not being fed, that's the number one Catholic eating disorder. I don't remember now who said that, but boy, that makes a lot of sense. If a Catholic says, I'm not being fed by going to Mass, that's the number one Catholic eating disorder. Because you don't realize who it is that you're receiving in Holy Communion. And once you do, it makes all the difference. Well, Erica, thank you. I do appreciate your kind words. And maybe it'll just be out there on social media in due time. Also, a note that comes in here from Tony, who says, Patrick, while I agree with your comment about Walmart and Kroger and contraception, there are some stores that the lady might go to that don't have those moral issues. And that's certainly true. Aldi comes to mind. As the last I checked, they don't sell drugs other than common headache medicine, over-the-counter meds. But your overall point is correct in terms of church teaching. To what I think was the first caller raised, I largely agree that the caller said she had never heard you give bad advice, and I'm aware of the qualifiers. That said, even though there are exceptions to many rules beyond God's law, it sounded to my ear like that woman wanted to bring the matter to her bishop. She is correct to do so. She may be an army of one. If God is for us, who can be against us? Well, fair enough. I totally understand. It's what's the old saying, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. And my impression was that she had already made an effort to try to correct this problem at the parish. She wasn't successful. She was looking for advice. And I said, you can write a letter. And of course, what I meant by that was either to the pastor or to the bishop, because he's the shepherd of souls. But having been down that road before, I think that the likelihood of that doing anything is pretty minimal. Doesn't mean that there's not good in trying to do something, and even if just for her own sake, trying to do something is a good thing. So thank you for your email. I appreciate it. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Sue in the Twin Cities. Good morning, Sue.
Good morning. I wanted to just get your take on a statement someone made basically related to the Spanish Inquisition and the Catholic Church's role in that. And basically, this person equated the Spanish Inquisition, Russian pogroms, and the Holocaust, and said they were all the result of intolerance and prejudice. I wondered what your take is on that.
Okay. Well, certainly a pogrom would be the height of intolerance if you're going on a killing spree and destroying homes and killing people because of their ethnicity or their religion. I would concur. That's about as bad as it gets. The Holocaust would be a supreme example of that. The Inquisition is something different, however. There were pogroms that took place in Spain against Jews and others, and we can't in any way exonerate that or condone that or even pretend that those things didn't exist. But that's separate from the Inquisition itself. And just a quick tutorial on that. The Spanish Inquisition is the most well-known Inquisition, but it wasn't the only one. There were, you know, there was the medieval Inquisition with the Catharists. There was the Roman Inquisition, and that's what Galileo got caught up in, and a few others. But most people, when they think of the Inquisition, they think of the Spanish Inquisition. So a bit of historical background can be useful. First is to remember that the Iberian Peninsula, so Spain and Portugal, had been completely overrun by the Muslim invading armies that had come out of, originally out of North Africa, so Egypt and Arabia and such. And they systematically conquered previously Christian lands, including the Holy Land. And so this was not done by peaceful missionaries going into these countries and seeking to convert the people to Islam. It was done at the point of a sword. And in fact, Catholic Answers has a helpful book called Not Peace But the Sword, which is an historical analysis, an historical overview of the way in which Islam conquered the Mediterranean basin. And keep in mind that the Mediterranean basin, for the, say, roughly 300 to 400 years before the rise of Islam, was predominantly Catholic. There were plenty of pagans there as well, but in terms of the predominant religious affiliation of the people in what is now Turkey and Syria and the Holy Land and Jordan and Egypt and Tunisia and all of the North African countries, it was Catholic. And so when Islam began to conquer these lands, it was intent upon more and more conquest, and eventually they conquered the Iberian Peninsula, which had been Catholic. So for the next 700 years, the Catholic folk who were living under this occupation, they wanted their freedom, they wanted their religion, they did not want the Muslim overlords to dictate to them what they could and couldn't do and how they could or couldn't practice their faith. And so finally, after 700 years of struggle, the United Kingdoms of Castile and Aragon under Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand, and they were the ones, by the way, who paid for Columbus's trip in 1492. He sailed the ocean blue. It was at that time that they finally were able to vanquish the Muslim invaders, and they drove them out of Granada, which is that was their last stronghold in the south of Spain. So they finally, after 700 years, they finally had a unified kingdom, and the Catholic faith had been reestablished, and the people were now free again to be Catholic without the Muslims telling them what they could and couldn't do. Well, here's the problem. As you can imagine, given human nature being what it is, there were people who were settling old grudges or trying to harm a rival or do something else that would harm somebody. And so there were accusations that would be raised saying, this guy over here, who was his family back in the day converted to the Catholic Church, guess what? They're secretly practicing Islam, or they're secretly practicing Judaism. They're posing as Catholics outwardly, but they're secretly practicing as whatever the prior religion was. And one reason that this was so white-hot important at that time was because they had just militarily expelled the Moors from Spain, and there was a great deal of paranoia about whether or not these secret conversos, they called them, whether or not they were plotting to help the Muslims return and reconquer Spain. Because when they were driven out, they said, guess what? We're coming back, and we're coming back stronger, and we're going to reconquer this place. So there was some paranoia there. So what happens is, let's say, Sue, that you and your husband were denounced by your next-door neighbor, and they claimed that you were a secret convert and you really were secretly Muslim. Well, you would have no way to clear your name because the authorities, the civil authorities, were not competent to determine whether or not you are actually a Catholic. You might say you are, but what does that mean? So this is when the king and the queen asked the Holy Father to delegate, in this case they were Dominican friars, delegate a cadre of priests who could find out. I mean, this person is denounced as being a secret convert. Well, you would go before the tribunal, the Inquisition, and they would ask you questions, and you would make a profession of faith if that's what was necessary. But the main thing is that you would be cleared from a false denunciation if, in fact, you were innocent. And most of the people were innocent. It wasn't something that was, you know, common, but it wasn't unheard of. And so the vast, vast majority of people who had been accused and had to go before the Inquisition and answer questions, they were exonerated and they went on their way. There were some who said, no, I'm really a Catholic, and they were cleared. But if they were found out later that they had been lying and they were caught in the act, so to speak, then they would be the ones facing imprisonments or fines or even execution. If somebody had been denounced to the Inquisition and they were found to actually be a secret convert and they had broken the law, thus, they would be imprisoned in some cases. Yes, there was torture involved, but that was true in Protestant England. And I mean, this was a terrible thing that was done regardless of Catholic or Protestant or even non-Catholic. Torture was employed across the board in those times, sad to say. And some people were, in fact, executed, but only if they had suffered a penalty. So let's say they were fined or they were imprisoned, and then they were released. Don't do it again. You don't have to be Catholic, but you can't practice secretly and pretend to be Catholic. Well, if they were recidivists and offended again and it was discovered, that's when the state would say, we're putting you to death, because it was considered a crime against the state. You were an enemy of the state, because the state and the church were so closely intertwined that an attack on the church was considered an attack on the state, simply because of the fear that Muslims might return and do everything I just said. Now, there was a separate issue, but related with secret Jews, those who are practicing Judaism in secret and not openly. Now, interestingly, Benjamin Netanyahu, who is the former prime minister of Israel, and he may well come back for all I know, his father was a scholar of this topic. And he wrote, I have it in my personal library, it's a tome, it's like 1,000 pages long, The Jews in the Inquisition by Benjamin. I think his father's name is Benjamin Netanyahu the first, I guess. And it's a scholarly, exhaustive overview of what actually happened in Spain. And it's not a pretty picture, but you see that it's not as many people nowadays assume that it was the Catholic Church saying, you have to be Catholic. And if you're not Catholic, we're going to kill you. That's never what it was. I'll leave it at that only because it's such a vast topic. But if you want a scholarly account of it, I would recommend Dr. Netanyahu's The Jews and the Inquisition. Or if you're interested, I have a chapter in one of my books called Pope Fiction. I have a whole chapter on the Inquisition that might be useful to you. So there's a long answer to a short question, but hopefully that gives you some more to go.
Yeah.
On.
Thank you. Yeah. I knew it was a big loaded question. So it's not accurate to say that it was Inquisition was grew out of intolerance and prejudice. That's like a simplistic answer, is it not? It's not accurate.
Well, yeah, I think that would be correct to say so. It didn't grow out of intolerance or prejudice in the sense of, let's say, racial intolerance or something. But there is the intolerance of sin, and there is the intolerance of deception, and we should all be intolerant of those things, starting with ourselves. But here's why I think we have to take that part into account, and that is that there is a certain kind of intolerance, and that is what we see in the Holy Bible. Actually, you see the Inquisition in Deuteronomy chapter 17, verses 2 through 7, and I'll read it to you. It says, God said, if there is found among you, in any one of the communities which the Lord your God gives you, a man or a woman who does evil in the sight of the Lord your God, and transgresses his covenant by serving other gods, or by worshiping the sun or the moon or any of the hosts of the sky against my command, and if, on being informed of it, you find, now here's the key, by careful investigation, that's what the word inquisition refers to. It means you're making an inquiry. You're making, as the Bible says here, a careful investigation. So he says, and if, on being informed of it, you find by careful investigation that it is true, and an established fact that this abomination has been committed in Israel, you shall bring the man or woman who has done the evil deed out to your city gates and stone him to death. The testimony of two or three witnesses is required for putting a person to death. No one shall be put to death on the testimony of only one witness. Now, here again, this is from Deuteronomy 17. So this is a biblical foundation of the concept of an inquisition. God was not being intolerant in a petty sense, but he was being intolerant of secret sin that would cause a contagion within Israel. So he was saying here, you have to be very careful. And if somebody is denounced as having done this, you have to carefully investigate to find out. And there have to be witnesses. It can't just be somebody's word against somebody else. But if you find that indeed this is true, then a punishment ensues. And in essence, this biblical foundation is what the Inquisition, all of them, were based upon, which was to protect the innocent. And if there were guilty people who were doing things that were intolerable, that was the purpose of the Inquisition. So intolerance in that sense, you could say, if that's what you're driving at.
Okay, well, this is, I'm just taking a statement from somebody that I know. And so I was just curious how. So that's very helpful. I knew you'd have some good insight into the whole historical piece. And it's a big question. But so I thank you for summarizing it so well.
Thank you, Sue. Appreciate that. And you can look up what Pope John Paul II had to say in his purification of memory speeches. He gave one specifically on the Spanish Inquisition and apologized for some of the evils that were committed in, well, he apologized for whatever evil was committed in the commission of the Inquisition, but he also frames it historically and kind of contextualizes what the Spanish Inquisition was. And most people nowadays don't really understand what it really was. Thanks for the call. Interesting topic. I'll be right back. Let me ask you, can the Catholic Church have a future if we Catholics don't understand our past? Experience history the way it should be taught in a free online class from Christendom College. Just go to principlesclasses.com.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
Okay, let's go to, where are we going? Let's go to Mark in Jersey Shore, PA. Good morning, Mark.
Morning, Patrick. Hey, so my question today is relative to marriage and remarriage. So a father has authority over his daughter, especially in relationship to marriage, that a suitor should come to him and ask for permission to marry her. But if the daughter then becomes a widow, does the authority then return back to the father so a new potential suitor should also ask for permission to marry the daughter?
I don't think so. I mean, I agree with the first part of what you said, but under the current laws of our culture here in the United States, first of all, no in that regard. And the church also does not say that that has to be done. In fact, the church doesn't even really say that in the first instance that the suitor should check with the father first. That's a time-honored custom that I personally endorse, and I've done that with my daughters. But the church does not place it as an obligation in any religious sense, but it is a very good custom. But I think in the second instance, it would be not likely or it wouldn't be requested because she's now a grown woman and she's of legal age and she's autonomous. It didn't used to be like that. Certainly in the times of Jesus, it wasn't like that. And women had to live with either a husband or their father, or they lived with extended family if in the case of being a widow. Women couldn't live alone. But in our culture, that's not the case. So if you were the father and your daughter became a widow, I could see why you would want the next man to ask for your blessing, and that would be a good thing. But I don't think it would be expected, if that's the question you're asking me.
Mm-hmm. And that is it. I'm trying to separate out. I mean, I know that it's simply a tradition, but I was trying to explore it biblically, and I haven't fully researched it. But I'm thinking, like, in terms of the book of Tobit, didn't she have six husbands before that seventh husband came along? I might be off by a husband there, but anyway, I was just wondering, and I still think that it's a good tradition. I still think that asking the father for the hand in marriage is still appropriate. Just to know, honestly, to know what the relationship is, because when you marry, you're going to be marrying the whole family. So it would certainly be better to just go in with a blessing as opposed to saying, well, no, you can't, and then you do it anyway. You're really off to a bad start.
That's true. I'd like to play devil's advocate, if you don't mind, not because I disagree with you, but because I see a few holes in that logic that might be worth thinking about. So let's say that your daughter gets married when she's 21, and then by the time she's 40, she's a widow. Now, for you to tell her that her suitor now, potential husband number two, must come to you to ask for your permission to marry her, she's not leaving your control. It's not like the first time around when she was moving out from your house to go live with her first husband. She's not moving from under your authority now into a marriage. She's already self-established. And so one potential problem I could foresee here is that if you're telling your 40-year-old daughter she needs to ask you, well, her suitor needs to ask you, it kind of infantilizes her. You know, it kind of treats her as a child, and she's not a child. She's a mature woman. And so a lot of it would depend upon where is she in her age and in her circumstances. But when she's leaving your house as a fresh-faced, wide-eyed 20-year-old girl, and now she's going to go get married, it is very appropriate for the suitor to come through you. But I don't think it's as appropriate or necessary, maybe, in the case of a daughter who's much older when she's a widow. That's just something to think about.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, I appreciate that. That's exactly the perspective I was looking for. So thank you. I'm trying to look at this from every angle.
You got it. No, I appreciate it. And it is an interesting topic, Mark. Let's hope and pray that our daughters never have to go through that situation. But those eventualities do happen for some. Thank you. 888-914-9149. We'll go now to Leo in Minneapolis. Hi, Leo.
Hi, Patrick. Yeah, I'm calling to return to the discussion regarding salvation only within the Catholic Church.
Okay, sure.
And what struck me as people have talked with you about it is that it might be helpful to have the discussion in a more general term rather than the specific circumstance because of the emotion that comes up with that. And what I mean by a general term, and I was trying to build somewhat of a syllogism here, but maybe start with a general question, like if God asks me to do something or reveals something to me as being true, and I say no to doing that, am I not separating myself from God? And I would assume most people would say yes, you are separating yourself from God in some manner. And then kind of could discuss from there that if you're separating from, isn't total separation from God the definition of hell? And then next question would be, if I don't say yes to God, if I willfully separate myself from God in this life in some way, am I not risking eternal separation from God eventually? And, you know, trying to, like I say, use more of a general general question to then get to the specific that if God has revealed the Eucharist to be true, and if God reveals to somebody that the Catholic Church has the fullness of truth, by them not going along with that, they are obviously then risking total separation from God at some point. Am I kind of going down the right path, you think, with that?
I think so, yeah. I mean, very well said. And your ironic tone, I think, would be very helpful in a conversation like that, because people who might otherwise get emotional or angry or defensive would stay more calm when you approach it the way you're doing it. I think it makes a lot of sense.
It took me a week to get to this point.
You know, what's interesting is that if you and I are both thinking about the same call that kind of sparked this discussion, I think it was last week, the gentleman who called was talking. And wasn't he talking about his wife who was Presbyterian? And so it was very personal and very specific. And so of necessity, I had to deal with it at that level. But I do agree with you that at a more general level, it's easier to be dispassionate because you're just talking about general principles as opposed to specific people.
Yeah. And I think, you know, a lot of us know people who are not practicing anymore or so those easily get emotional. So anyway,
that's a good point.
It took me a week took me a week to try to form the points in a rational way. So perhaps that'll be helpful.
Well, you did well.
In the future.
You did well, Leo. Thank you. Great talking to you. Let's go to Teresa now in Elmhurst, Illinois. Hi, Teresa.
Hi. Yes, Patrick. I just had a quick question. Our Catholic school here in Elmhurst just rolled out and announced yesterday that they're teaching a social-emotional learning program. It's a secular program, and they're teaching it twice a week. They're taking 15 minutes out of religion class twice a week, so they're dedicating 30 minutes a week to this. And it seems to be controversial, the SEL learning. And I just wondered, I had never heard if you had, I listen to your program all the time, and I don't remember you ever touching on this, and I wanted your opinion. This is grade school and middle school.
Okay. Now, when you say ESL, I assume that's English as a second language. Is that what you're referring to?
No, no. Social emotional learning. It's called SEL.
Oh, SEL. SEL. Okay.
Yes.
So what is that? What is it?
So it talks a lot about mindfulness and reframing a fixed mindset to a growth mindset. It talks a lot about like self-care and, you know, feelings and feeling good and what makes you feel good, you know, and how to make yourself feel good.
A charbroiled steak and a glass of red wine. That makes me feel good.
Right. Right.
But I bet they're not talking about that.
I've looked through the program as much as I could. And it, like I said, it's very secular. It opens up into like the LGBTQ plus. One of the things that I had read was a whole thing on a book that was entitled How to Be a Better White Person. This is up and coming.
So it's
this
ideology. It's ideology under the guise of kind of squishy terms like self-care and stuff like that. Is that what it amounts to?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I have nothing to say. I mean, there's nothing I could suggest other than, as a parent, you have every right to, if you're concerned about it, and I could understand why you would be, you have every right to take it up with the, you know, practicing the principle of subsidiarity. You start at the lowest common denominator and try to work it up if you have to. Start with the teacher. If that doesn't work, talk to the principal. If that doesn't work, talk to the person in the archdiocese who's in charge of the school system. It's hard to know what kind of reaction you'll get, but you have every right as a parent, especially since you're writing the tuition check every month, to have a say and a voice in what your children are receiving at school. I don't know how likely you are to be successful, but there's nothing wrong with expressing your concerns. I think that would be a good thing.
Okay. Yeah. Another thing they had on there was chair yoga. I mean, I don't know enough about it, but I definitely am going to do that. I wanted to ask you your opinion before I went forward, but thank you.
You're welcome, Teresa. I'm so far removed now from kids being in school that I think things nowadays are a lot different than they were when my kids were in school all those years ago. So my hat's off to you parents, because you're dealing with challenges that didn't even exist when my children were in school. So I'm trying to learn as you are, you know, how to best navigate through these tricky waters and what's the right thing to do. But I think you're right to be concerned and you're right to voice your opinion.
Okay. Yes. It is very difficult these days. It really is. It's a lot of time and energy needs to go into, you know, figuring everything out, and to be on top of it, you know, and some parents just kind of let things happen, but I'm trying to be as efficient as I can. So thank you.
Kudos to you, Teresa. You're welcome. Great talking to you. Hey, by the way, before we go to our next call, in November, we celebrate the lives of our fans, family and friends who have passed away, and you should pray for their entry into the kingdom of heaven. And you can join us here at Relevant Radio in prayer from November the 2nd through November the 10th as we offer a novena for these holy souls. We invite you to submit 20 names, up to 20 names if you wish, of your departed friends and loved ones at relevantradio.com/souls between now and November 10th so that we can pray for them by name, and we will. And Father Rocky especially will be leading this novena. And when you submit the 20 names, up to 20 names, that is, of your departed loved ones for us to pray for, you will automatically receive for free some reflections from Father Rocky each day of the novena to help you enter more deeply into prayer. So this is absolutely free. There's no cost or anything. Just go to relevantradio.com/souls and let us know for whom we should pray. Thank you. Let's go to Fred in Brooklyn, New York. Good morning, Fred.
Yeah, good morning, Patrick. How are you?
Doing well, thank you.
Good, good. I listen to you all the time. We donate on a regular basis, and my wife is an advocate with the magnets on each of our cars. So just to let you know where we are, that's great. We love the programs and all the programs and all the hosts. We love it all. The thing at Walmart's, I was a little concerned about that because you stated that it was definitely not an abortifacient because, this is what you read. I don't know. So I looked up on, I Googled when conception can take place, and I found a site that said how soon after sex do you get pregnant. It was very well family site and supervised by a nurse. And it says conception can occur within minutes or hours after intercourse. So that led me to believe that you could be pregnant right away after sex. And what would happen with this jewel that you take?
Let me interrupt, Fred. I apologize. What I would recommend is go to the Walmart.com website and just type in the word Julie, G-U-L-I-E. And all I was doing was reading the description of the product that they give. I wasn't trying to say that this is absolutely correct, but check that out and maybe call me again soon and we'll talk about it. I'll pray for you. Please pray for me.